3RPH is pleased to present the memoirs of Tilly Aston, Australia's blind poet, author and philanthropist. The story told of the many-faceted life of this talented woman is intriguing. The memoirs of Tilly Aston is published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pamela Adams. Episode 15.
Ramadanovich of Yugoslavia. In the days of my eager search after information concerning the blind of other lands, through the medium of Esperanto, I got into touch with a gentleman of Yugoslavia, whom I consider one of the most eminent workers for our cause, as he was an original thinker in his plans and efforts to ameliorate the lot of the sightless in the Russian and Balkan regions. This was Mr. Velkio Ramadanovich, director of the Blind Institution at Zemun, near Belgrade. Like myself, he was always on the watch for any exchange of ideas, and soon after the conclusion of the First War began a correspondence with me, having read an account of my doings in one of the Esperanto papers, then in circulation throughout Europe. I quickly discovered his remarkable qualities, his wide philanthropic interests, his readiness to blaze new trails for aiding the sightless, for whom he thought and worked. His story, which I learnt from one of his staff of blind teachers, was a romantic one. As a young man, Velkio had wandered about the Balkans and into Russia, not at all clear as to his mission and calling in life. Then, one day, he found himself in an empty, quiet church, facing the responsibility of a decision concerning his future. And there, upon his knees before the altar, he received a revelation of God's purpose for him. He was to go out and become the protector and father of the weak and afflicted, and devote his scholarship and great natural gifts to the cause of humanity. Out into the world he went, toiling for many causes as they presented themselves: the deaf-mutes, the crippled children, the aged and infirm. Finally, the needs of the blind in those Eastern European countries were thrust upon his great heart, and he turned his talents in that direction, to the exclusion of other spheres of active work. He settled in Yugoslavia, and at Zemun founded the school and workshop for the blind, bringing to bear upon the project all his fine powers of organization and a liberal understanding of the viewpoint of those whom he desired to uplift. Very soon he had a braille printing press installed, from which poured out books, music, magazines, to supply the needs of the starved readers of that part of the world. He introduced Esperanto, and encouraged his blind charges to study, through this auxiliary language, the history and literature of other peoples, and, as a part of their training, urged his teachers to get in touch with workers among the blind, wherever a contact could be made. Mr. Ramadanovich was a linguist, and knew English, therefore, so he could use any press matter I was able to send him, such as local reports and newspaper cuttings. These he would translate and give to the press over there. And in this way, his Australian correspondent became known in Yugoslavia to a group of people interested in the blind movement. Many matters of interest came my way from this part of Europe, but perhaps the most remarkable was the astonishing experiment of setting up blinded soldiers on the land. Mr. Ramadanovich had a theory that men reared in agricultural surroundings would be more likely to succeed at farming than at a trade in a workshop, when overtaken by loss of sight. They would require some financial help and a certain amount of rehabilitation training, after which he hoped they might become self-supporting. So he secured a tract of land near the town of Novi Sad, had homes built in a little village for 50 blinded soldiers, and in due course settled them there as small farmers with tools, livestock, and other necessary equipment. The last report received showed that the experiment had been a success. There is a delightful story connected with this unusual venture. The wise Ramadanovich knew that blind men could not manage this kind of life without womenfolk. So he and his wife shouldered the responsibility of finding wives for those who had none. Advertisements appeared in the papers for girls accustomed to farm life and willing to share with the blind men the task of founding homes and families, with the prospect of a fair amount of economic security. It would seem that this was a pleasing prospect, for plenty of young women answered the call, many times the number of applicants needed. Mrs. Ramadanovich chose the 25 brides, explained to them fully the duties ahead, and put them through a brief course of training with the blind at the Institute at Zemun. Diaries for the girls were provided, and finally there was a glorious peal of wedding bells, and 25 couples were united before the altar. In spite of gloomy predictions, this marriage experiment proved quite successful. In 1937, the settlement was flourishing. Some of the men had accumulated handy little nest eggs, and there were 76 happy children, all born at Veternik, as the village had been named, by Mr. Ramadanovich. This outstanding man, with his large heart, keen brain, and friendly understanding of his charges, became a much sought-after counsellor in every department of humane effort. In Poland, Russia, Romania, in fact all over the Balkan states, he was called upon to solve the problems of many handicapped classes. Decorations and honours have been bestowed upon him by many governments, and he seems to have had the love and confidence of those about him. According to a photograph which he sent to me, he is handsome and dignified, and his countenance would seem to indicate a benign and fatherly spirit. Just before the present war, he completed 40 years of service to mankind, and 25 as the guardian of the interests of the blind of Yugoslavia. To celebrate the occasion, there was printed a memorial book dealing with his various philanthropies, a tribute to a life of devotion and self-sacrifice for others. Among the pictures appearing in this book is one of myself, included because I was for years a faithful letter friend of this distinguished benefactor of my fellow blind. Now that war has ravaged the world, I have lost touch with him and his work. I can only pray that such a splendid man has escaped the fire and sword of the ruthless factions of this European debacle. Continued leadership of the Association for the Advancement of the Blind. Under this heading, I shall try to state some particulars intended to clear away the impression that during a long period of its history, I had nothing to do with the above-named association. I have already referred to the request of the chief of my department, when I was engaged as teacher, that I should abstain from public work for any organization of the blind, so as to obviate the opposition met at the time of my appointment. Actually, I did refrain from taking prominent part in my former work, but my influence was well sustained throughout the 13 years I was in the school. It is not always essential to hold office in order to have a share in guiding state affairs, for the power behind the door can be very real, and it was in that domain I was able to help my old friends in many practical ways. Prior to my appointment, however, I had been forced to somewhat lighten my duties outside the home because of my mother's failing health, but other blind people were ready to step in and shoulder the burden. I was still a trustee, and this office I never relinquished, but immediately after the announcement of my successful application for the post of head teacher at the blind institution through the education department, I made a disagreeable discovery, namely that I was spoken of as a traitor, a deserter of those for whom I had worked for 17 years. The institution where I was to begin duty was not popular with the blind of that day, for reasons which need not be discussed here, and apparently I was to share in its bad reputation, and come in for some amount of distrust and disfavour. I was deeply hurt by this manifestation of hostility, which was at least justified in those who were loudest in proclaiming it, for most of the blind, who needed employment, must depend on the institution, whatever the disadvantages. While I was to hold an independent position as a government servant, even if my working hours must be spent in the same building as theirs. In winning this appointment, I had not supplanted any rival among the blind, so I hoped and expected that my success would have been a source of pride and pleasure to them. Then the vociferous section found a leader, who had come quite recently into the ranks of the sightless, and set about burying the dead monarch, to wit, myself, their founder, and for long their leader. This was the more easily managed with the restraint that bound me in the background, which I could not explain to them fully. nor could they grasp my difficulty without such explanation. I tried to understand the situation from their point of view, excusing their loss of confidence in me for the time. But it added much to the trials and sorrows of my first year in the hostile camp. I cherished the hope that time would bring the balance into a true line, and prove to these fellow workers of mine that I was no deserter of their cause. I went to some of the meetings and had my little say on various matters before the chair, and ventured to proffer my opinions, as heretofore. I was soon to learn from the militant section that I was no longer wanted in or out of the meetings. They talked loudly of new blood being needed, new and more progressive policies which must be formulated, of fights and affrays with the old organization to rectify wrongs, etc., etc. I was amazed at the fury this aggressive minority had stirred up. At last one evening, I was present at a meeting where a most unwise and futile step was advocated, and I rose to make a protest, as I considered it meant complete ruin for our young association. I was refused a hearing, and I left the gathering, sad and disappointed. Not so much because my opinion was unacceptable, but because of the ingratitude and lack of courtesy I had a right to expect. I retired, resolving not to thrust myself upon the members again, until time should make my situation clear to them, until a more fraternal spirit should have blossomed forth above the suspicion and unreasonableness of this passing storm. Yet my heart was there, for I realized that this was just one of those queer upstirrings which often occur at the onset of a fresh, would-be leadership, at the entrance of a man grasping power rather than a modest ministry to the needs of his less fortunate fellows. This little fracas disturbed our peace many years ago, and all who had a share in it either learned the wisdom of cooperation or vanished from our ranks altogether. It happened at a time when I had many troubles, and possibly for that reason looked very dark at the moment. I was enduring the opposition in my schoolwork, also my mother's illness, extended over this period, ending with her death in December. I held on to my membership of the association and to my office as trustee, and I determined that in some way I would go on helping. It was chiefly through this office I retained my hold during the years of teaching and long after. I quietly kept in touch with the loyal sections of the workers, especially the trustees, who would come to my home that I might share in their deliberations and help with such morsels of wisdom as experience had brought me. Nothing important was ever done without my knowledge, for it was the practice of the faithful among the members to drop in for a chat when there was an important matter likely to come up at the general meeting. From the foregoing, it may be judged how sound is my claim to have led this organization continuously since I founded it, with my 7 blind friends in December 1895. This is not the place for a complete history of its activities. Suffice it to say that our home at Brighton grew larger and more useful. We opened a hostel for women in Windsor and one for men in South Yarra, while the needs of the blind in the north of the state were catered for by a small home at Bendigo. The visiting system among the isolated blind was greatly expanded. Social work, begun at our first annual picnic, has been fully matured in our socials, concerts, and other forms of enjoyment, likely to brighten the lives of our people. The blind themselves did most of the work without any reward, save the satisfaction which always follows service. After my retirement from the education department, many years of bad health prevented me from taking part in public life. So I went on as private stimulator and honorary consultant, shut in. Meanwhile, my name as an author was appearing more often in the press, and people began to remember my former efforts in literature. Things were in this wise when Mr. Marx intimated his desire to vacate the presidential chair. Mr. George Maxwell, MLA, had held that post for a long period, and at his death Mr. Marx had been elected to the office. One day a deputation waited on me and invited me to accept nomination, and after careful thought I agreed to stand, but only on condition that too much would not be expected since my health was far from reliable. This was agreed to, the members stating that my small reputation would be of value apart from any service I could render. And we settled down on these terms when I had been duly elected. The work of most presidents is perhaps more ornamental than routine, and I set out to do my decorative job, with vice presidents to help, and my blind and seeing friends to steady the load a little. The association was in reality a brotherhood of the blind, with big plans for more work to come. We were providing hope and consolation so much needed to minimize the physical handicap, often of quite recent occurrence, and the blind of this community have a much brighter lot for our efforts. How happy it makes me to remember that I have had a hand in this rehabilitation, this opening of the gates for my fellows in darkness. This happiness is all I have ever asked. However, it has been augmented by a public recognition of my service to the community in the shape of the Distinguished Citizen's Decoration from the King, an honour twice bestowed, and which assuredly warmed my heart and stirred me up to yet greater endeavours of my kind. Another poem of Tilly's. Gates. Gates are made to keep things in, what we have and what we win, made to guard the things we nourish, where life's best may grow and flourish, errant fancies here confined, neath the outer world's cold eye. Close the gate, the exit bar, small ambitions of the mind, simple loves that swoon and die, while we learn what things we are, how to grip and hold on high that lone being who is I. Gates are made to keep at bay those destroyers who betray, wanton, will to crush and break every fair thing that we make, trampling down the growing plant, scorning our ideals as cant. Love becomes a desert dry, where the thirsting soul may die. Let them stay without the gate, in the outer darkness wait. He who parleys with the foe, sure defeat must later know. Gates are made to let things out, to the masses round about. There's perchance a garden drear, bedded on a rock austere. Precious dreams their grasp elude, coarse realities intrude. Who shall satisfy their yearning, squalor into beauty turning? Open gate, a roadway fair, we have riches and to spare. If a man will truly live, he must get and he must give. The lure of the tropics. Most of the children of my generation drew much enjoyment from reading of such books as Robinson Crusoe and Coral Island, and I suppose that these tales of the tropics shed a glamour over such regions for us living as we did in a clime where spices grew not, and where bread must be made from the much-processed wheat instead of coming straight from the breadfruit tree. So I had always longed to walk beneath coconut palms, to listen to the singing tides upon the coral reefs, and to touch and smell the fragrant plants that flourished under tropical suns. I had little hope of realizing this romantic aspiration with the two handicaps of blindness and limited means. But in the year of the coronation of our present king, my opportunity came. For 20 years I had paid a quarterly premium for insurance, and now I could claim the handsome sum of £100. Wisdom said I ought to put this aside for a rainy day, for sickness or for old age, etc. Of course, this would have been the prudent way, but in view of the simple mode of my life on a small but assured income, I played on the idea of a trip to the north, and it gripped me so fast that at length I decided to spend most of my slowly accumulated wealth on such a pleasure cruise. I purchased tickets to Cairns and back by the motor ship Manura, bought some necessary gala clothes, and prepared to enjoy myself. I was not disappointed. Miss Bradford was my companion on this excursion, and we both collected a store of experiences which have enriched us ever since. I got in touch with Mrs. Ryan of the Queensland Tourist Bureau, and she must have laid a trail of friendly feelings toward me right up the east coast of Australia. It was truly wonderful how easy the agents made the way for me, assisting me to participate in every excursion on the programme of the tour. When I got to Sydney, I was interviewed as a distinguished traveller by some of the papers, had a party in the city to meet my numerous cousins and friends, too scattered to look up individually in their homes, and finally Miss Bradford and I took a little sightseeing on our own account before going back to the ship. At Brisbane, through the kind interest of Mr. Scott, secretary to the Blind People's Club, I received even more publicity. The newspaper came aboard the ship and photographed us. And, by the way, there must have been an accident with this picture, for in the journal it showed me with a glorious black eye, much to our amusement. I sincerely trust that the readers did not imagine I had been making whoopee, while far beyond the critical surveillance of everyday circles. Many people called on me, including Mrs. Percy Peace, wife of the acting premier. This gracious lady came down to the boat for us, drove us round the city, gave us morning tea at Parliament House, where we were shown many historical relics, and inspected the beautiful floors and furnishing made of rare Queensland timbers. Next, she drove us to the Forestry Department to see the marvellous variety of woods produced in the state. And later in the day, I received two lovely jewel boxes made of native maple as a souvenir from the Queensland government. It was all very thrilling after the life of comparative seclusion I had had for many years, and all this kindness was a definite refresher to my spirit. In Brisbane, I made a broadcast as a distinguished visitor, was tendered a complimentary social by the blind folk and the Esperantists combined, and met many delightful people, whom I shall always remember with pleasure. Here, too, was the first touch of the tropics, noticeable in the trees and the flowers, and in the milder airs of those beautiful mid-May days.
And that brings us to the end of episode 15, of the Memoirs of Tilly Aston, published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pam Adams. The series was produced in the studios of 3RPH Melbourne for the RPH Network.